Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy that we can begin the week and begin today's program with two people that I know from Carthage College, Sarah Gorky and Rebecca Winberg. And they are both part of Carthage's Aspire Center. And we're going to be finding out about the mission of the Aspire Center and about the Aspire Conference, which is going on at Carthage both today and tomorrow, in which an impressive array of impressive Carthage graduates are brought back in one way or another to Carthage to speak with current students and to help kind of give them some guidance and inspiration in terms of planning for exciting futures of their own. Sarah Gorky is director of the Aspire Center, and Becky Winberg is manager of communications and special projects. And the two of them, I think, are working as co-chairs of the Aspire Conference going on today and tomorrow. And we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
Good to be with you. And we are recording this, by the way, on Friday morning, so you aren't right in the thick of the conference itself, but obviously on the eve of it, I'm sure you're incredibly busy, so thanks for making time for this conversation. Sarah, a quick word from you first in terms of when the Aspire Center was created and why, the essential purpose it serves.
Absolutely. And so just for clarification, I'm the Director of Career Exploration and Design. Our head of the Aspire program is Lisa Hinckley. And so there's a team of us in the Aspire Center since about 2019 that have been at the helm of redesigning what our students experience here on campus. The Aspire Center is our version of helping students build not just a professional life, but a personal life that truly prepares them for not just the 4 years on campus, but beyond. So for the last several years, we have been building a set of programs and opportunities and redoing how the traditional career services model looks like on our campus. So from day one, even when students are in the admission pipeline and curious about Carthage, we help support them and help build their understanding of their own personal skills, interests, and values, and how that might impact their choices moving forward. We have built a variety of programs, but the Aspire Conference is in its third year, our third annual Aspire Conference, and it's our big signature event to kick off the year, really wanting to make sure our students feel supported within their first weeks on campus and beyond.
So help us understand the distinction between kind of the old traditional model of career counseling at a college versus what you are doing. And maybe a couple of tangible examples of the specific things that you offer that 10 or 20 years ago would probably not have even been considered within the auspices of something like career counseling?
Sure, I'll start and then I'm going to actually pass it over to Becky. The traditional career services model is not bad necessarily, but we were seeing that most students did not take advantage of the resources we have until about their junior or senior year, when it got real for them about needing to get a resume, for example, or a cover letter in the traditional sense. And we know that by that time, it's simply too late. It's just too late for them to build a cachet of understanding, to leverage our alumni network, our community partners. And so the Aspire Center meets that challenge and gets it to them earlier. And one of our brand new programs we have on our campus this year, and Becky can speak way more intimately about it than I can, is our new MAP program for our students.
Yeah, and so our new MAP program, it stands for My Aspire Plan. And basically, it's an online app for students to track and progress their experiential learning opportunities. So it builds a record, but there's also different achievements and competencies that they're developing through this program. So when a student is working on their resume at 2 a.m., they can log into their MAP and not be lost and not have to start from a blank page. And so it walks them through a guided process, and they can also win some pretty fun incentives and gamify the experience. But it provides a space for reflection and also to remember all those amazing things they did back their freshman year as they're a senior writing the resume.
Wow. Do you think there are certain departments on campus in which this kind of model works especially well? And for instance, the MAP program that you were just describing, that fold in very, very naturally and effectively, while for others, maybe is it a little more awkward fit? Or by and large, do you think this is something that potentially can serve every single Carthage student, no matter what field they are planning to enter?
So in my role, and this is Sarah again, I actually serve undeclared students mostly. That is my purview. And so with that being said, every student can benefit from it, because even undeclared students who don't know where their pocket is necessarily yet on campus have to go through that spirit of reflection and that spirit of identification in order to find out where their talents and skills are honored. And so wherever they end up trickling into or out of, that honors that spirit of reflection that we provide at Carthage anyway. Traditionally, of course, you can make a justification for some departments acknowledging resumes and cover letters more pipeline, but we think it benefits everybody, and we've seen amazing engagement so far with our students being very excited about it.
Very good. What difference do you think it makes to be involved right from the outset? And what would you say is the most important role that the Aspire Center is playing with those students who have just arrived and are probably, in many cases at least, nowhere near ready to be thinking about what they most tangibly want to do after college? What is the most important role that you play for those students very early in their Carthage career?
That's a good question. I will say that I think the most important role is that we are a familiar face, that we provide them a sense of belonging and community. We have the ability to have established over the course of their 4 years a trusting relationship with them and help see them learn and grow and have a safe space for reflection. We provide them that community that they don't have when they come in and transition into their time on Carthage. We're an immediate friendly face for them.
How is the Aspire Center positioned in relationship to what we think of as those that offer them kind of ongoing registrational assistance and guidance and so on, the advising center, the advisors that they have academically? Are they under your purview, or are you under their purview, or do you work in cooperation?
So at Carthage, we have what's called a holistic advising model, and it's a both and sort of situation. My role in particular, I actually do academically advise the undeclared students and work very closely with our registrar's office and helping ensure that our undeclared students make some intentional choices to make sure they're persisting through their academic journey. But it's all connected, right? We work with our faculty, but at the end of the day, we're just one piece of a very larger puzzle happening at Carthage to support our students.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Sarah Gorky and Rebecca Winberg, who are both with the Aspire program at the Aspire Center at Carthage College. And we are about to talk about their third annual Aspire Conference, which is actually occurring today and tomorrow, Monday and Tuesday. And Sarah, just say a word about why this was created in the first place and what it's been like to see it kind of evolve and grow over the last 3 years.
Sure. So part of Carthage's mission and vision is to really educate expansively and integrate regionally. And so this was one of President Swallow's visions for our campus when he came on board and as the Aspire Center was coming to fruition. And we really want to welcome our community to join in what our students are experiencing and what our alumni are able to contribute back and really engage in these essential developmental and life skill building opportunities. So this is our third year, as you mentioned. Our first year was fully in person. Last year, of course, we had to pivot to a strictly virtual platform. And this year, we get to make the best of both worlds. So we have a variety of in-person experiences and live streamed opportunities for our community members to engage in if they don't feel comfortable or aren't able to come to our campus over the course of the conference. And they can tune in by going to live.carthage.edu. Overall, we have 20 plus programs and sessions taking place.
Wonderful. And it sounds like, Rebecca Winberg, you've been on the ground floor in terms of putting the conference together and I assume issuing invitations and so on. Tell us a little bit about that process of sort of trying to think about who should come and what kind of stories would be most potentially valuable to those attending the conference.
Absolutely. With our notable and amazing alumni and community out there, we had an abundance of ideas. And so it was more about how do we scale back and be really focused and sticking with our theme. And this year's theme is You Are Here, From Aspiration to Action. Last year, we were kind of disconnected with the pandemic. And so now we are back on campus. We are here together. And so we really wanted to acknowledge that as you are here. And we're so glad you're here. And then from the aspiration to action, we're helping students acknowledge that they don't have to do it by themselves. We can help them, one, create their idea, but then like, let's make a plan together and then help you do that. And so we started with looking back at our learning goals and deciding where we wanted to connect the sessions and experiences back to those goals and our core values of creativity, leadership, professional development, and entrepreneurship. And so these connections are really explicit. And we also try to connect directly to our courses so that the faculty can infuse this conference within the things that they're already doing in their curriculum. And so with our alumni, for instance, we have Javen McGinnis, who is leading the charge of our 75 years of Black excellence. And he was so involved on campus. And so this is an alumni leader that we want our students to get to know. And we know that he can help open doors for them.
So tell us a little bit about how this conference is put together. I mean, is it kind of a schedule? Do things happen at appointed times? Is it a little more free-flowing than that? Give us kind of the sense of the structure or framework of it.
You bet. So it kicks off on Monday night, tonight, with a creative space where the students are just getting hands-on and playing because we think that creativity is important. It expands our minds. And so we have Hot Mess Studio from Kenosha coming in to do some splatter art. We have Make Your Own Custom Swag and just been really intentional to have some fun, which is not a normal keynote experience of a conference, right? And then the next day on Tuesday, we kick off right away from 8 a.m. and we go all the way through the evening, and same with Wednesday, but with all different types of sessions. So the students are waking up when we're having breakfast with them on their way to class and chatting with their career specialists. For lunch on Tuesday, we have Adrian Hoyt from CNN, who's doing a session about Uncharted. She started as a religion major and is now a VP at CNN, which is an uncharted path. And so we're really excited to have our students meet Adrian. We also have Kate Colbert, who is a best-selling author and entrepreneur, coming for the next day for lunch. We also have our local friend, Carolyn Frisch, who's with the United Way of Kenosha County, and working with our undeclared students of just talking about, like, what is your journey and what do we want that to look like and how to help them. And we also have Caroline Riley, who is an alum, who is from Google. We have these powerhouse alums at Carthage that we want our students to know about. And they're just so humble and kind and want to give back to our students and our community. And lastly, we have another local name, Charmaine Harris, who, you know, was an ex-felon and has totally reinvented his life. And he received a full ride to Carthage, got his master's degree, and he's talking about using resources and how to carve your own path. And so it is a powerhouse schedule. There are sessions that can be live streamed for our community, but our community can also come in person. So we're really excited to have the best of both worlds in this situation.
So what happens at each of these sessions? I mean, is it kind of the same, but the guest is different, or are each of these very distinct experiences? I mean, and are they giving a speech and then answering questions, or are these laid out in kind of different ways? I mean, depending on who the guest is and what they have to share.
It is all across the board. We really want to honor the strengths of our alumni and our community partners. There are some amazing workshops planned. For example, the session with Caroline Riley, our alum from Google, she's leading a session called I Am Remarkable, which is actually a Google-sponsored workshop. So break out into small groups, specifically working with confidence building for women and underrepresented populations. Very dynamic, very engaging. We have some smaller breakout sessions. We have some panel conversations with Q&A with current students and alumni. As Becky mentioned, we have these lunch sessions where you can come and get free food and listen to our keynote speakers. So there really is something for everybody. I think it's also important to honor and acknowledge that our campus is still fully in session during this time. Our students are going to and from their academic courses and extracurricular activities. So we've built it for them to come when they can and leave when they have to. And no matter when or if they can engage, they will get something from it. So we encourage our alumni to have these dynamic conversations throughout to make sure that our students really are experiencing the most bang for their buck when they're able to come and engage in the conference itself.
Yeah. So help us understand the piece about the outer community, outside community, taking part in this, partaking or observing it in one way or another. What do you see as the purpose of that? I mean, obviously, this is conceived primarily with Carthage students in mind, to serve them. In what way do you see this serving the community or being of interest to the outside community?
There's a real element of Carthage is part of the Kenosha community. And our students can't stand alone and learn everything from just this insular set of experiences. We want our community to feel like they can engage and integrate with us. And we see true value in an intergenerational component of this. In fact, we've also sent out invitations to regional and local guidance counselors and high school students to encourage them to engage with us as well. So we can have a full gamut of experiences, because no matter where you're at on your journey, these are transferable skills and understandings that will mean different things to different people at different times. But at the core of it, they're essential to what we are at Carthage and what the Aspire program is also.
Nicely put. So, Rebecca, Talk about how the invitation was received from some of these heavy hitters. I mean, alumni who have gone on to do great things and are having, I'm sure, incredibly busy lives. Has it been a challenge to kind of rope people like that in, or at least for the most part, have they eagerly embraced this possibility? And for that matter, is it challenging for them to help them understand what this Aspire conference actually is, since it seems to be something relatively unique?
Yeah, oh gosh, when we put out the invitations, they all eagerly accepted, and we're just so excited to come back to campus, one, to, you know, see their residence halls and see how the campus has evolved and changed, but also to celebrate their time at Carthage and to be able to give back. Although they are heavy hitters, they are humble, and they're Carthaginians. And so they have already been living the Aspire journey. And so it's these lived Aspire, I'll say, testimonials of like, this is how this happens, and this is the progress. And so they, when working with, for instance, Caroline Riley, she's like, fill my day. How can I do all the things? I just want to participate and have fun and help students. At the end of the day, they just want to say, let me raise my hand and help the students.
Very good. We should just look back for a second. What was it like last year when the Aspire conference had to be entirely virtual? And how did it end up going?
We looked really long and hard at some digital platforms that could support the uniqueness of the Aspire conference. We did not want it to feel traditional. We did not want it to feel cut and dry. We found an awesome platform that we're actually continuing to pull into this year's conference too, to have, as I mentioned earlier, that both and experience of in-person and virtual. And we ended up having amazing engagement. We had around 300 students and community members engaged throughout the course of the conference last year. Again, a powerhouse lineup of alumni and community speakers. And we had a wonderful time. It's been really exciting to see over the course of these 3 years on campus, already the culture and climate changing and the vernacular changing on our campus, of understanding that this is what we do now in fall. This is a thing that happens at Carthage, the Aspire Conference. And so we were really proud of our efforts last year, but we didn't want to keep it all virtual this year because we also know how powerful the energy of in-person can be.
So what is roughly the proportion in terms of what's happening this year virtually versus in person?
Everything is in person, but there are a select few opportunities that will be live streamed. And again, you can go to live.carthage.edu to see that full lineup of virtual speakers. Our lunch sessions with Adrian Hoyt from CNN and Kate Colbert, the best-selling author, are both being live streamed, in addition to a few other key sessions, including Caroline Riley from Google on Wednesday afternoon. So we wanted to encourage our campus community to come in person, our large community to come if you can, but also tune in if and when you can as well.
Very good. So for people who want to do this, is there any cost involved, or is this something entirely free and available to anybody?
The conference is entirely free. We received a large donation from one of our benefactors, Jan Tarbell, and so this is the gift to the community. And we don't want to have any barriers to people participating and engaging. And so it's zero cost, but high impact.
Very good. So again, things are kicking off this evening with kind of a creativity celebration, and then a full schedule of speakers and guests over the next couple of days for this third annual Aspire Conference at Carthage College. Sarah, could we just talk for a moment about when Carthage students approach the finish line in terms of finishing up their 4 years? At that point, does the work of the Aspire Center begin to more closely resemble the traditional model of career counseling? And not, you know, not that that's a bad thing, but I mean, in a sense, does your focus change, or do you feel like through the course of the 4 years, your purpose, your mission, and the way it is delivered, does that remain fairly consistent?
And I think for some, yeah, the reality kicks in where they do need resumes and they do need cover letters. But to Becky's earlier point about our MAP program, it shouldn't be a new conversation for them. It should be a conversation that has been evolving and developing over the course of their 4 years here on campus. And when they cross that finish line and graduate, their time with the Aspire Center is not over. We still allow all of our alumni to retain total access to all of our resources and connections within the Aspire Center. So their time is not done. It may end up looking a little bit different, but hey, isn't that life? It changes and it grows and it evolves, but we are always here for our Carthage students and our alumni.
Very good. Is part of the purpose of the Aspire Center to help more students successfully complete their degree program? I mean, to, in fact, make it to the finish line, because of course that's a concern at every institution of higher learning that I am acquainted with, just making sure that as many that as possible who start are able to finish successfully.
Yeah, career outcomes are obviously always at the forefront of what we want to acknowledge for our students. We also know that that sense of belonging is essential. And if they don't feel like they belong on our campus, they're less likely to persist and overcome. So we want to provide that sense of belonging for them. We also want to provide them with the toolbox of skills and interests and acknowledgement of how to utilize that to the best of their ability. We know there's that statistic out there that in 5 to 10 years, 40% of jobs may not even exist and or will have radically changed. And so we want to prepare our students as best as possible to meet those challenges and that changing climate in order for the Aspire Center in Carthage and frankly our greater community to be as successful as possible.
Very good. So, Rebecca, remind our listeners who may be intrigued by what we've been talking about and who think they might want to be part of this, I mean, to take in some of what's being offered, exactly where do they go and how do they go about partaking of the Aspire Conference?
Absolutely. They can head to the Carthage website at carthage.edu/aspire and just click on conference. There's a really easy registration page, and they're in.
And do people need a fancy kind of computer or a fancy kind of anything in order to access this?
Not at all. They can use their cell phone. There's an app that they can download, or they can just use their cell phone through their normal browser. It's very easy and accessible.
Very good. That sounds good. Well, I appreciate this chance to catch up with both of you and to hear more about the third annual Aspire Conference at Carthage College, which again is kicking off tonight. Is that event tonight intended basically for students only?
Community are always welcome. It is later in the evening around the student schedule, so it goes till 10 p.m., which many community members might already be in bed. But anyone is welcome.
Great. And then, of course, a full docket of speakers and presenters then over the next couple of days, Tuesday and Wednesday. And again, at Carthage's website, you will be able to find all the information that you need. Sarah Gorky and Rebecca Winberg, it's been great to speak with both of you. Best wishes with this third annual Aspire Conference at Carthage. And thanks again for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment.
And for the next few minutes, we're going to be delving into the fascinating and long history of one of the most powerful shows on network television, Grey's Anatomy. A really illuminating book has been written about the show called How to Save a Life, The Inside Story of Grey's Anatomy. It's written by Lynette Rice, who is an editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly, has covered many facets of the entertainment industry for a quarter of a century, and has written very powerfully about Grey's Anatomy over the years. And this book is published by St. Martin's Press. And Lynette Rice, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's my pleasure. Great to be here.
I really have enjoyed this book. And I want to also add, if this isn't too offensive to anybody listening, I'm actually not a huge diehard fan of Grey's Anatomy. And the reason I even mention my own kind of relationship with the show is that nevertheless, I found your book absolutely fascinating. So I don't think you have to be a fervent fan of Grey's Anatomy to really enjoy this book. That being said, I suspect that you have written it mostly with fans of the show in mind. Or did you have a wider purpose?
I thank you for that. That's such a great endorsement, too, for coming from somebody who didn't really watch the show. It was a tough nut to crack for me because when I started it, it was hard to figure out how am I going to wrap up at that time when I started. It was still just started up on the 16th season. How do you cover everything that happened in 16 seasons? You can't. So I just focus on the stuff that, as a reporter, always interested me, and that's, of course, the humble beginnings of the show, the crazy departures on the show, and the moments in time that generated so much heat, so much drama that had all of us reporters scurrying to get every last scoop out of that show.
Right. And as a matter of fact, that's, you know, kind of one of the recurring themes is how to cover a phenomenon like this. Can you explain the intriguing title to the book, How to Save a Life?
One of the great things about Grey's Anatomy is that it was part of this growing movement for television shows to use pop music to help set the narrative on the show. And one of the songs that they used was a song by The Fray called How to Save a Life. And I go back and I talk to a couple of musical artists about their songs that really became huge international hits thanks to Grey's Anatomy. And I talked to, you know, The Fray about how they came up with the song How to Save a Life. And it was actually a very poignant story. It was that they worked in a rehab camp, and they met a young addict who was really battling with a drug addiction. And his happy ending never really came. He was on and off the drug. And The Fray, just they kind of had this epiphany, like, the sign at pools where it says, like, what to do if somebody drowned, and that inspired the song. So anyway, that became an anthem on that show, How to Save a Life. It was used multiple times in episodes. And so when you hear it now, you just think of Grey's Anatomy, which is such a testament to the power of that show.
Mm. You've already made brief mention of the fact that this show began rather unremarkably, in a sense, under circumstances in which probably nobody, even those who most believed in the show, would have predicted what a runaway hit it would ultimately become. Explain to our listeners just how unremarkable the beginnings were, or kind of the unlikely circumstances under which this show began.
So this was developed right around the time of Lost and Desperate Housewives, two huge ABC shows that had just launched. They were doing really well. And then there was this drama, this medical drama that was bought by an unknown writer by the name of Shonda Rhimes. They were able to shoot six episodes without pressure to get them on the air like the next few weeks. So they got them all in the can, you know, in relative silence. They were off in the valley of Los Angeles doing that. One thing that made even people on the cast, the crew, feel like ABC didn't care about the show was the fact that Grey's Anatomy had a Dr. Shepherd, just like there was a Dr. Shepherd on Lost. There was nobody in the executive suites that even considered the fact that, okay, my God, we're going to have two Dr. Shepherds on our network. The Dr. Shepherd on Lost, by the way, was played by Matthew Fox. He was the lead in Lost. And, of course, Patrick Dempsey played Dr. Shepherd on Grey's, but they stayed with it. So as soon as this show aired, it immediately exploded, and they immediately picked up more episodes, and it just ran from there. It was the epitome of overnight success for that show.
I have a feeling a lot of people will snap up this book to read about the cast, but I must confess that what I found every bit as interesting, in some cases even more interesting, is some of the people whom we never see on camera who play pivotal roles. And one of them, with whom I'm so intrigued, is network executive Steve McPherson, who was described by a couple of different people in your book as, in a sense, an exceptionally meddlesome, hands-on studio executive. I mean, really interfering in a lot of different things and trying to kind of micromanage a lot of aspects. And he's probably not unique. And we hear so many horror stories about the guy from the network who inserts himself into the proceedings. I appreciate that we hear from him directly as well as those that had to work with him. What was your takeaway about Steve McPherson and his contributions to the early days of Grey's Anatomy?
Covering network presidents has been one of the fun aspects of my job over, 25 years of covering television, because everyone has their own drama associated with them, and then they have their own legacies to deal with. Steve McPherson did not have a positive legacy at ABC. He ultimately left amid allegations of harassment, sexual harassment with women at the network. And so, I mean, he didn't leave on good terms. And those allegations kind of swirled, too, when he was overseeing Grey's Anatomy. There are also feelings that he never liked the show. And you'll hear the producers say this. You'll hear Ellen Pompeo say this today. He never really liked the show. And there's always those kind of comments, too, about, network presidents. I mean, armchair quarterbacking, he didn't like it. But the fact is, maybe he didn't like aspects of it, but he still has to greenlight this show at the end of the day. And he did pick up the show despite having some reservations about, certain scenes in the pilot. Because, they shoot a pilot, and then you make the decision from there, do we go ahead and make it to a series? Which he made that decision. So it rests on him. So it seems a little unfair, and I agree with him about that, to say that I did, to look back at him and say he was mean to the show, he didn't like it, because he still picked it up.
For sure. Yeah, it's a complicated story, and we realize that that sometimes network executives can be portrayed in rather cartoonish fashion as people that mostly meddle and don't let the creative folks do their work and so on. And I like that we hear more about Steve McPherson than just that. Another person off camera that I think is so interesting is costume designer Mimi Melgard. And she describes some of what was important to her and to Chandra and to Peter Horton, the director of the pilot, in terms of what these people should look like, down to details like the kind of scrubs they should wear. I found this fascinating. Can you just tell our listeners a little about this?
Well, scrubs are not that sexy unless, of course, somebody like Patrick Dempsey is wearing them, and then you see this stuff. You know how even today we'd be in a 7-Eleven and a doctor comes in and his scrubs, it's like, okay, he's showing off he's a doctor. But they just kind of hang. They're meant to be comfortable. They're meant not to necessarily be in the way of your daily work. But they still had to make them sexy because, this is supposed to be a sexy show. So they worked with scrubs. And, they definitely tried to take them in so they would still show off the figure of their young actors while still looking, making them look like doctors. You know, ultimately, Mimi's goal was to never have the clothes overpower the characters, overpower the show, a rule that wasn't, you know, followed like on Shonda's subsequent show, Scandal. In fact, the clothes were an integral part of that show. They didn't want that to be here on Grace. The attention had to be on the actors. So she tried not to make sure that the clothes, you know, spoke volumes, for the exception of one very important dress, and that was Katherine Heigl's dress when she went to a formal dance with her beloved Denny early on in the show. I mean, that dress itself, this pink ball gown, has a life of its own.
Mm. And she also says that one of the reasons to kind of keep the show, the clothing subtle, is that if the show went into syndication, which she believed it ultimately would, the clothes would look a little more timeless, which of course makes a lot of sense. Well, let's talk about this amazing cast. And I think at one point it's T.R. Knight who describes them as a ragtag team of weirdos with a kind of unexplainable chemistry. And of course, I think he's speaking about the cast fairly early on in the show. Tell us more about that unexplainable chemistry that was present in this ensemble.
Well, I think it all helped that they were all relative unknowns cast together. I mean, Patrick Dempsey was the only one who had a career that, you know, people recognized. I mean, they'd all been working, but they weren't household names. And they were all close in age. And so they were all in it together. And the great thing, especially about the very beginning, they worked in silence. They weren't on the air yet, so they could bond. They had a chance to bond, which was neat. So early on, they were treated like equals. They felt like equals. And so they were able to kind of party like equals, too. There's a old saying in television that, you know, and it's from the actor's point of view, the first season, I work for you. The second season, we work together. The third season, you work for me. And in many respects, several of the actors kind of operated that way. You know, they were in it together for a while, but then their lives changed. The popularity of the show changed. Their individual personalities, their Q rating, so to speak, changed. And so it became a very different culture.
Mm. Shonda Rhimes is, of course, amazing. And you describe her, I think, in one of your introductions as brilliant. I mean, unmistakably brilliant, but an untested showrunner. And, of course, that's another role that she has with the show. And I find that to be an intriguing combination of someone who is brilliantly talented and yet almost brand new in the TV business and taking on responsibilities she'd never taken on before. Describe just how well she managed to do that.
Well, what typically happens in television, if there's an untested person, they bring in other executive producers who have more experience to surround that untested showrunner. In this case, it was Peter Horton, who was an executive producer slash director. He's the actor from 30-something who went behind the scenes. And another very tested showrunner by the name of Jim Perriott. They were there to help keep the train on the tracks, but it still was Shonda's show. She took it over. And she just was very intuitive about what the audiences wanted from the show. One of my favorite quotes in the whole book was from a writer on the show, a longtime writer on the show. His name is Tony Phelan. And he was talking about how what typically happens in a scene between Meredith and McDreamy is the camera will go back and forth if they're having a deep argument. But in this one particular scene, the camera stayed focused on McDreamy. And Tony was like, Shonda, we need to cut back to Meredith. And Shonda said, no, I want him talking right to the camera because I want that woman in Iowa to feel like he is talking to her. McDreamy is her man, her husband, her love of her life. And that was such a genius idea because that's why so many women fell in love with this man. That's why so many people even today can't even imagine that Patrick became difficult to work with on the show toward the end, because he's perfect in every way. And if you, you know, that's the, you know, the strength of his acting was he made people believe that he's this way 24/7. He's our dream man 24/7.
Well, and of course, it sounds like he was incredibly kind and gracious for quite a number of years, but after a while that starts to wear away and he does indeed become difficult. And of course, one of the hallmarks of the story of Grey's Anatomy, and it's told very well in your book, is of how things become difficult for certain actors who ultimately have to depart, are killed off or whatever, and all of those stories are here. I think it's important for us to talk about the fans. And of course, the fan base of Grey's Anatomy has been ferociously passionate right from the start, in part because of kind of the way things were set up, giving them forums to express their every opinion about the show. Tell us more about this, and if television has ever seen, had ever seen anything like it, or has seen anything since, like the fan base of Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, it started with blogging. Shonda made all her writers blog about episodes. So that created one of the first platforms for fans to weigh in. And then, of course, there's the advent of social media, which has completely changed network television. You know, people can get very involved in a show to the point that fans believe that they should be able to decide how a show should behave, how stories should play out. And the writers, to their strength, you know, first with Shonda and then with Krista Vernoff, who now is running the show, who's basically, you know, Shonda's mini-me, you can't let the fans decide, because fans will keep people together far longer than they need to be. You know, a story needs it needs conflict to continue to live, to continue to be interesting to us. If everyone's happy all the time, it would get bloody boring quick. So you can't always listen to the fans. And these fans, especially now that the show has gone to Netflix, they're new young fans. They are so opinionated. They are so invested in these characters. We call them, you know, obviously stans. These are the ones that just live for the romances on these shows.
Hmm. Last quick question. What would you attribute the long tenure, the long success of Grey's Anatomy, a success that I think has exceeded everybody's expectations?
Grey's, for the most part, is a serialized drama. I think people still like serialized drama. And you think about a procedural, like a Dick Wolf show, a Law and Order, when you can come in and come out and not feel lost. People are invested in Grey's. They're invested in the life of Meredith, her trajectory from an intern to this brilliant surgeon now. People like that. They want to follow along the story. They want to feel like they're a part of it. And I think that's what's really helped. And Ellen is a huge part of it. You know, she got people to love her. That she's a part of the family now, and they don't want to see her go.
Hmm. Well, and I say again, as a diehard fan of ER, I loved your book. I loved it start to finish. Again, it's titled How to Save a Life, The Inside Story of Grey's Anatomy, and it's published by St. Martin's Press. Lynette Rice, thank you so much, and congrats on a great book.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for reading.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, our guest is Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, who will be offering his perspective and analysis on an array of current events and issues. On Wednesday, it's the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, and she is scheduled to be speaking with Dave Giordano and with Kenosha County Executive Jim Cruiser about the Pike River Restoration Project. On Thursday, I'm looking forward to speaking with Dr. Herschel Kruger, who is from the theater faculty at Carthage College. We'll be talking about the production, which is opening their current theatrical season, Harold Pinter's award-winning play, Betrayal, which actually opened this past weekend. On Friday, I'm very excited to share with you an interview that dates back to the mid-1990s, and an interview that was done by my predecessor as host of the morning show, longtime WGTD news director, Bill Guy. It's a conversation with the author of a book called Smoldering City, one of the definitive accounts of the Great Chicago Fire. And this Friday, the 8th of October, will mark the 150th anniversary to the day of that tragic event. So we will be replaying that interview by Bill Guy